Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. When deportations happen, it can be devastating to family members left behind. We'll hear from a woman whose father was sent back to Mexico after living most of his life in the U.S. It's also a difficult time for international students. We'll visit with one from Nigeria living here on a visa. Roller derby has seen a revival. We talk with some women and men who have found the sport. Also, the president of a university employee union talks about funding higher education in the state. Prison lockdowns cut incarcerated people off from educational opportunities, and they often occur due to staff shortages. Experts say peer mentorship can fill the gap. And social influencers online, how some children are used to create content, often without reaping the financial benefit. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. When a person is deported by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, it also affects the family that is left behind. A year ago, Vanessa Lopez found out her father was being sent back to Mexico after living most of his life here in America. His forced departure left her feeling hopeless and significantly changed her relationship with her dad. Lopez wrote about her experience for the Chicago Sun-Times and produced this audio postcard.
On a November morning last year, my phone rang right before I was headed to class during my first semester of graduate school at Northwestern University. It was my mother. "Your father. He's being deported," she said. My father, who had lived in the country for nearly 3 decades and worked himself to the bone for me and my siblings, was being sent back to Mexico. As a Latina and the oldest daughter of 3, guilt is something I often carry. Like most children of immigrants, I shoulder the expectation to make my parents' sacrifices in migration to the country worth it. When I finally did it, move away for college, for opportunities my parents made possible, but will never experience themselves, the guilt followed like a shadow. "Hija, tienes que hacer más con tu vida." Do better, be more. So when I learned my father was being deported, before walking into the class of a university I worked so hard to enroll in, I was devastated. Within days of getting arrested by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, my father, now 47, was back in his hometown of Aguascalientes, Mexico, a place where he once fled and now barely knows. My father was just a teenager when he arrived to the U.S., searching for opportunities that could better him financially. Soon after, he met my mother. When we came along and grew older, all of us, U.S. citizens, tried to change my father's immigration status, but we were unable to due to the red tape and complex laws. So he ended up back in Aguascalientes, where he stayed with a family friend and slipped into alcoholism. Our conversations back then, when they happened, centered on the same pain, how hard he had worked, how he had lost everything, how he had nothing left. I had to learn how alcoholism affected our interactions, how some of his ordeals were real, how others weren't, reminding myself I couldn't fix or save him. My father started to feel like a ghost. The distance wasn't just physical. It felt like I was losing the man who raised me. In April, I got another call. My father was back in custody at an immigration facility in Texas. He tried to re-enter the U.S. because he was desperate, jobless, and alone, he told me at the time. My father did break the law by crossing the southern border without authorization, but he did so to go back home, a home in the U.S. where he spent more than half of his life building something that was erased with paperwork and inhumane policies. My father remained at the Texas Detention Center until October. During those 6 months, he went completely blind in one eye and lost most vision in the other, because he wasn't receiving adequate medical care for his type 2 diabetes. But he also got sober. I don't know when I'll see my father again. For now, I carry the weight of his sacrifice while navigating the gaping hole left by his departure. I am the daughter who made it, who did better, while knowing that better came with a cost. For those of us left behind, we bear witness helplessly, watching our loved ones disappear slowly, out of this country, out of our lives, and out of the personalities that made us smile.
Vanessa Lopez is an audience engagement specialist for the Chicago Sun-Times. You can read her full essay at suntimes.com. And this piece was produced for radio by Lauren Frost. It's been a stressful year for many international students. The Trump administration is canceling visas, rewriting rules, and monitoring students' social media. Peter Medlin sat down with a Northern Illinois University student from Nigeria to talk about life on a visa.
In the fall of 2023, the semester was in full swing, the weather was getting cold, and Babatola Arugundade was more stressed than ever.
I was missing home, I was struggling with food, then the weather became cold, I was struggling with the weather.
He thought about quitting. Mental health struggles are common for international students, and to make matters worse, Tola came to the U.S. to study mental health. He's a doctoral student at NIU's Counselor Education and Supervision Program. Tola wanted to study in the U.S. to build bridges, to connect Western counseling theories and techniques with African psychological principles, but all he could do that fall was keep his head above water. It was his first time in the U.S., and it was a grueling visa process just to get here.
You know, you go to an embassy in Nigeria, U.S. embassy, and you see over 5,000 people there applying for visa. How many are going to get approved? Maybe 100.
But he says the challenges start way before you enter the embassy. First, you have to apply to a school, interview, and get accepted.
Then, not all admission comes with full funding.
Can you pay tuition and fees? It's especially tough when over 60% of Nigerians are multidimensionally poor, meaning they experience poverty across several indicators like health and living conditions. And Tola was accepted at NIU, but he says he was initially only offered a 10-hour per week graduate assistantship, even though he was eligible for 20 hours. And without a full scholarship, he had to raise nearly $20,000 to prove to the embassy he could pay for college.
I started soliciting for money to borrow from different families, different friends, to ensure I have the sufficient amount. It wasn't easy.
It took 2 months, and then he had to secure an interview at the embassy.
But in Nigeria, it's more like a sport. It's like a competition.
He created a WhatsApp group with other students, taking turns watching the website day and night in case an open appointment pops up. It can take days or weeks, and Tola didn't have much time.
We are kind of religious back home, so people pray.
Finally, a date came up, July 5th, and he got it. And in the meantime, he got even more good news. The university could now offer the full 20-hour graduate assistantship, and that means he didn't need to borrow as much money, and that raised his approval odds. But now he also had to update key documents, and it took days of calls and emails, and he got it just in time for his interview.
I was scared. It's between either yes or no. And interview at the consulate is less than a minute. It's not as if they interview you for 30 minutes. It's less than a minute.
Why are you studying in the U.S.? How are you paying for school? He rehearsed his answers because he knew just one stutter could cost him. And thankfully, he was confident. He says he saw the interviewer reach for the white approval paper as he answered, and it was a massive relief. But now he only had a few weeks to get a passport, book a flight, find an apartment in DeKalb, and say goodbye to his family.
So I left Nigeria July 30. Then I entered 31st. Then I resumed work August 1st. So there was like no rest for me.
A few months in, he was exhausted. He thought about transferring or quitting. International students are held to a high standard. GPA minimums, full class loads, only working in jobs related to your field. It's difficult, especially as you're adjusting to a new school and a new country. And his first semester seeing clients in the U.S. showed him how hard it would be to build bridges between Western and African approaches.
I remember when my supervisor at the place came and talked to my professor here about the kind of approach I'm using, more like as if I'm not competent enough. Then I remember them calling me at my department trying to talk about, oh, you know, what kind of struggle am I going through? That period, I think I felt a bit betrayed.
He says he'd always get assigned black clients, and there was a misconception that because he's black that they had the same experiences, even though he's not African-American, he's African.
The first year was really, really tough, and it ignited my research.
That project was understanding the supervision experience of Black counselors with multiple minority identities. You can be Black and an international student, or Black and disabled, and Tola says all of those identities intersect and should be acknowledged in supervision. And he earned a grant to fund that research in 2024, and Tola says he found his participants were forced to do a lot of extra labor.
Over explaining to their supervisor about their identity and also try to protect themselves from their supervisor, and also protecting their client from their supervisor, because once you can't trust your supervisor regarding certain things, you want to protect your client.
He's now expanding that research for his dissertation and expanding beyond just Black counselors to all counselors with multiple minority identities. And Tola also recently received an award from the Illinois Counselor Educators and Supervisors Organization. And while he's personally settled in at NIU over the past 2 years, life on a student visa has become more and more challenging. This year, the Trump administration revoked, then reinstated scores of student visas across the country, including several at NIU. And the administration said it would review all 55 million visa holders for potential violations, and they're also vetting social media accounts. All that led to international enrollment falling 20% at NIU this fall. Provost Lori Ellish Piper said some students were unable to get their visas in time to start the semester, and more visas are now subject to additional review called administrative processing, which can take months. And Tola says he knows several international students with full ride scholarships who were denied after administrative processing.
They don't tell you why you are being denied. That is the frustrating part. So you don't know, maybe you have put something on your social media 10 years ago. You don't know.
Even if you're approved, processing delays could cost you a spot in a program or a GA position. Rule changes have also affected Tola personally. His initial visa was for 2 years.
Most African countries, they don't give 2 years visa anymore. Let me use my country as a case study. Now they give 3 months visa.
The new short visas also only allow a single entry. So if you leave the country, whether for vacation or university research, it invalidates your visa and you have to start all over. And with all of those new changes, he wonders if he could have even made it to NIU if he was going through that process now.
I don't think I would have that luck.
He says it makes him sad because he sees how much international students contribute to their schools and the economy. Tola knows a lot of students who live in fear that their visas could get ripped away at any moment.
I don't live with fear. That's the only way. I'm not just on that surviving mode. I'm in the living mode. Life comes at us very fast. Policies will come. I try to still stay optimistic.
He hopes to graduate within a year and eventually return to Nigeria to keep building bridges between cultures and break down the barriers that keep people from getting the help they need. I'm Peter Medlin.
Farmers can't hire enough workers. With President Trump's immigration crackdown, the ag workforce has shrunk by at least 150,000 people this year. Ag labor prices are surging, and the crisis is driving some farmers out of business. But as Frank Morris reports, some in the ag industry say it could be a moment for changes allowing more foreigners to work legally on American farms.
U.S. farmers grow everything from apples to zucchini, with enormous amounts of grain, meat, and other stuff we consume thrown in. It's a very diverse industry with one common problem.
Labor is my biggest challenge. Every year, it seems to become more and more of a headache.
That's Brandon Batten. He grows tobacco, corn, and soybeans south of Raleigh, North Carolina. 1,000 miles away, near Ripon, Wisconsin, organic farmer Tracy Vins has the same problem. She says native-born Americans don't want to work that hard.
People in our community around us, let me say, just do not want to farm. We get an applicant here or there, and they come out in loafers and khaki pants and think, oh my gosh, you mean I'm going to get dirty?
So producing food in America depends on workers from overseas. About 70% of U.S. farm workers were born elsewhere. More than 40% of them are in the country illegally, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So if President Trump carried through with his campaign promise to deport all undocumented immigrants, it would paralyze the food system. ICE raids hobbled produce farms and a meatpacking plant in Omaha this spring. Trump's crackdown turned up the heat on a decades-old problem and sparked a new advocacy group, Grow It Here. Batten and Vins were speaking on a Grow It Here webinar. The organization's spokesperson, Christy Boswell, was a White House labor advisor in the first Trump administration.
I think the time is now, and it needs to be now, because farmers are have reached a crisis point. We have farms that are going out of business. We have food prices at an all-time high.
Boswell and many farmers want to make it easier to hire people from abroad. They want the H-2A visa system streamlined and open to more workers. It's already tripled in size in the last decade, but Boswell says it's a pain for employers.
The challenge with the H-2A program is that it is incredibly bureaucratic. Four agencies touch every single application. It is also very expensive.
With housing and transportation, which have to be covered, the expense for employers can run upwards of $30 an hour. And farmers hate all the paperwork. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins says the administration is lowering H-2A wage rates and simplifying the application process.
We're doing everything we can right now within statute to make it better, easier, more efficient, and cheaper for our producers to use that program.
This is a turnabout for Rollins, who just this summer said the Trump administration wanted a 100% American workforce. She said Americans on Medicaid could replace foreign workers. So Nick Lavendowski, head of the Kansas Farmers Union, says not all farmers trust the White House on this issue.
Well, you know, the president says one thing when it comes to this, and the Secretary of Agriculture says another. So it makes me think that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. That's concerning.
Congress is another wild card. Matt Teagarden, chief executive of the Kansas Livestock Association, says it would take legislation to really fix the system. Immigration hardliners have blocked that for decades. But Teagarden says that Trump's immigration clampdown may put them at ease.
I think that border security is really key and will allow some members of Congress who previously would not be part of the discussion about a more comprehensive solution that we've needed for 30 years, or I don't know how long, way too long.
There are a number of bills circulating on Capitol Hill that would allow in more foreign workers and ease the labor crisis in agriculture. Teagarden says Washington may finally be coming to the realization that the U.S. will either import workers or import food. I'm Frank Morris, Harvest Public Media.
We have more to come on Statewide. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. Solar panels are becoming a more common sight across the Midwest, and some farmers are finding advantages in growing food under the panels. That practice is called agrivoltaics. Jana Rose Schleiss reports on how the technology is being deployed across the Midwest.
Shortly after 8 a.m. on an August morning, Linda Hetzel is clipping herbs, vegetables, and produce from the vines on her farm north of Kansas City.
Italian parsley, cutting celery, peppers. I'm trying peppers, which you normally think would be only in full sun.
Hetzel's peppers are growing in raised beds and are shaded by 18 solar panels hoisted more than 8 feet off the ground.
There's no blossom on it yet, but the plants look healthy.
This is Hetzel's first growing season experimenting with agrivoltaics. The solar array that powers her home also provides shade as she harvests produce in the Missouri heat.
In this heat, it's really bad. I have to get up at first light because by 10 o'clock, stuff wilts.
The potential for solar energy infrastructure to offer a respite from heat for farmers and the food they harvest has been studied over the last few years. While the jury is still out on whether solar energy can be married to the most typical types of farming in the Midwest, such as large-scale row crop production or raising cattle, small-scale produce farmers like Hetzel are finding success. Other farmers across the Midwest are asking whether agrivoltaics can solve another problem, access to land. Increasingly, small-scale farmers have trouble finding land near their metropolitan customers. It's something Kashua Berry thinks about a lot.
Every time I see land space, I'm like, food.
Berry is the farm director at Minnesota-based nonprofit The Food Group. The organization offers a variety of training programs for people who want to learn to grow organic foods sustainably and sell them locally. Over the years, Barry has seen farmers ready to start their businesses only to be stymied by the same challenge, securing a stable place to grow food. Undeveloped land around the Twin Cities can be prohibitively expensive for beginning farmers, and renting leaves them susceptible to changing prices and lease terms. So Barry has taken to brainstorming creative ways to find land for emerging farmers.
My kids make fun of me because they're like, Mommy's probably just thinking about how many tomatoes or how many watermelons can we grow. I'm like, yes, you know me so well.
Barry and the food group have partnered with a solar developer to pilot long-term farming leases for the land within a solar array. The project's farmers get to use the space for free, and the solar company gets the land maintained. Something Stacy Peterson says sheep are also especially good at.
These solar companies have created hundreds of thousands of acres that need to be managed across the country. And they need land management and vegetation management, and solar grazers are perfect for that.
Peterson is executive director of the American Solar Grazing Association, an organization working to connect solar developers with shepherds. Over the past few years, sheep grazing amid solar arrays have become an agrivoltaic success story. Whether agrivoltaics can suit other types of agriculture without decreasing productivity of the farm or the power plant is still being studied. But small-scale food farmers in Missouri and Minnesota hope the future is made in the shade. I'm Jana Rose Schleiss.
The Trump administration this month proposed a new rule aimed at cutting protections for millions of acres of wetlands and streams across the country. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco has details.
The new rule would end protections for wetlands and streams not immediately connected to larger bodies of water. Robert Hirschfeld with the Prairie Rivers Network said that's bad news for Illinois' already dwindling supply of wetland habitat.
In Illinois, we do not have comprehensive statewide wetlands protections. That loss of the Federal Clean Water Act means that it is open season on wetlands in Illinois.
A study from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign found the new rule would impact up to 90% of Illinois' remaining wetlands. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
Imagine if millions of people watched you grow up and saw every embarrassing moment captured. For the generation that's grown up with social media, that can be their reality. Some families have created entire businesses out of filming content of their kids and posting it on platforms like YouTube or TikTok. But there's not much guarantee the kids will get their share of the profits, much less their privacy. Illinois is the first state to pass a law that compensates kids for this type of content. It was inspired by Shreya Nelamaltu, an Illinois teen, who wrote a letter to her state senator. And Sasha Ann Simon spoke with her about it, along with Carolyn Isom, a comedian and content creator who's an advocate on the issue.
Shreya, what made you reach out to your state senator?
I learned about child influencers over the pandemic, and I was just shocked that this exploitation was kind of happening in plain sight, and there was no legislation in place to protect these kids. So I decided to reach out to my state senator.
What's it been like for you growing up in this age with social media?
Lots of my peers and people I know want to be influencers. It's been pretty normalized, and so many child influencers have honestly grown up alongside me.
Mm. That's interesting. It paints such a different picture when I recall my, you know, teenage years.
Yeah, you know, I feel like influencing is the new hot career. It seems so glamorous, but when you really learn more about it, especially when you get into it from a young age, it's a lot more sinister than it seems.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about this law. How does it work exactly?
It's designed to kind of allow these kids compensation for the income that they are generating. And so if a video is generating enough revenue, you know, this is for actual family bloggers, not just parents who are posting their kids online. Mm-hmm. Then if the child is in the video, let's say 30% of the time, then half of that percentage, so 15% of the video's revenue, has to be deposited in a trust account for them.
So parents will put aside 50% of the earnings to their child, and it's based on the percentage of time that they're featured in a given video.
Yes, exactly.
The law also allows teens that are over 18 to take legal action.
Yes.
And so this is if their parents featured them in a monetized video and they didn't pay them for it.
Yeah, you know, ideally these parents would be proactive. You know, we always want to assume that they have the kids' best interest in mind, but this is kind of a fallback for these kids if that doesn't happen.
Right. Caroline, let's bring you in here because this is the first state, Illinois, to actually put any regulations on the books when it comes to this topic. Why do you think that we haven't seen more legislation so far?
I think the technology is just relatively so new. When cars were first invented, we didn't have seatbelt laws or drunk driving laws or anything like that. All of that came later. And I think that we're in the Wild West era of social media and that the laws just have to catch up to the technology.
Yeah, you said earlier, Shreya, that this, you know, this now feels like our new norm. Now that the law is in place, though, how are you feeling about that and what it will do for your peers that you say are really immersed in this kind of work?
You know, I'm really excited. I hope it can offer them some protection. I didn't want this law to be kind of stifling that dream if they wanted to be an influencer, but rather, you know, giving them an extra layer of protection if they need it.
Your thoughts, Caroline?
I think the law is a great stepping stone. Now, as to the question of should kids be in monetized content at all, I don't think so.
Hmm.
But
why not?
One step at a time.
What's your reasoning?
I think that, first of all, it sets up this dynamic of your parents are your employer and your workplace is your home and your work is performing the details and private moments of your life for an audience. I think that people have this misconception that, oh, it's just putting a camera in there, but it's what these kids are always doing anyway. It's just their normal life. But I think of family vlog content like reality TV in that it takes so much effort to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And effort that the kids are having to make. When I see a video of a toddler trying on 5 different outfits, I used to work as a preschool teacher, and I know that that's not so easy for a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And I think that it puts a lot at stake. It puts your family dynamics at stake to be profiting off of being visible mm-hmm. for people.
As much as the next person, I'm entertained by a lot of these videos. I remember yesterday catching for the first time a particular family that I think they're super popular, but I had just seen them for the first time. They've got 2 toddler sons, and the older one does these voiceovers that are, you know, just hilarious. Like he voices over, you know, other comedian content, and it's funny and so forth. But what happened was I watched another video that happened to show the behind the scenes of how long it takes to film this child saying the lines and making sure that his lips are moving, you know, with the actual words. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, he's like 4 at best. And like, that's a lot of work. And so this regulation, Caroline, though it helps address this compensation issue that we've been talking about when it comes to these kids, what more would you like to see?
France has a law that no children can be in monetized content before the age of 16. Ideally, I would want us to work towards that
mm-hmm.
because it's not just an issue of potentially messing with your family dynamics. It's not just an issue of kids working because it is work. And I think a lot of people love to scoff at influencers. And because they like to scoff at influencers, and not recognize that influencers are doing work, however mm-hmm. difficult or not difficult that work is, they don't acknowledge that the kids are doing work. But beyond that, it's just so deeply unsafe in terms of creeps on the internet.
And you will talk to parents who say, I mean, our children are not working. They're just, we're just capturing moments as they happen. how do you respond to something like that, Caroline? I'd actually love to hear from both of you, but you first, Caroline.
I find that so disingenuous. The children are working, they're performing. These parents that defend what they're doing, they have a huge financial interest in defending what they're doing. But I've spoken to parents who didn't know who I was, in terms of they didn't know that I have a big heart for activism for kids on social media. And I was just at a social media type event, and a parent told me that they don't understand why people are so outraged that they did a Dove campaign with their baby naked in the tub. These parents are willfully ignoring the harms of what they're doing because it's making them so much money.
What are your thoughts, Treya? What kind of strain does this put on the kids?
It's really not natural to the parents that are saying it's just, you know, like a home video. It's so much more different than that, because you have to have these kids, you know, sometimes parents make them pose for thumbnails, or they surprise them with something and they make them do 5-6 takes of the same thing. It's not natural, and it's not just filming their everyday life. There's a leaked clip of a YouTuber instructing her son, who was already crying, I think over a pet, they lost their pet, to pose in a different way for the thumbnail. And I think that just perfectly encapsulates how these parents expect their kids to act for a vlog, because it's not real life.
And can young kids actually understand what it means to upload a video to social media and consent to this type of work, Shreya?
I really don't think so. You know, it's hard for even now to imagine 1,000 people, let alone 1,000,000 people. And, you know, when you're that young, you don't understand really how permanent the internet is. And it's not your fault that you don't understand that. No one is explaining that to these kids. They're just really vulnerable out here and being exploited for views.
Caroline, you created a TikTok series satirizing family vloggers and showing what might go on behind the scenes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I called that series the Sandwich Family Series, and I've done a lot of satire of family vlogging. My goal with all of my satire is to point out the camera. I think that we are primed to take the camera for granted as if it's something that's natural to be there. But the question I'm trying to encourage people to ask is, why do I have access to this? Should I have access to this? And who is benefiting from me having access to this? There's gentle parenting family vloggers that will set the camera up and then they'll talk to their kids about the toy they broke and how that was irresponsible and how they needed to calm their body down. And you'll see the comments full of people who experienced rough childhood saying it's so refreshing to see a parent handle their kids gently. And I just want to scream, but it's not gentle because the camera's there. Like, you can't take this content as what it would be if the camera was not there.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to one of your skits.
We're going to Universal Studios? We're going to Universal? Yeah.
We're going to have to do that again. You don't seem surprised at all.
I'm not surprised. We've done this 1,000 times.
It's called acting. Try it.
I am acting. How much more do you want me to do, Mom? I already seem insane.
One child of family vloggers reached out to you. What did they share with you?
This was over 2 years ago, when I had just been doing other skits. And their identity is anonymous. They're a teenager. They're still in this situation. And they told me that my content helped them realize that they were being exploited. And they shared a lot of the difficulties of being in a family vlog. They had seen countless crude messages about them from the time that they were little. They had been made to perform on every major day of their life. They had also been made to perform when they lost a pet.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was precious, nothing was sacred. And they really emphasized to me how the employer-employee dynamic was the thing that potentially harmed them the most out of everything, was just being their parents' employee.
Mm.
And they told me that it's not worth it. They wrote a letter that I shared publicly. And in that letter, they said, if any parents are thinking about doing this, I want you to know that it's not worth it.
Caroline Isom and Shreya Nelamultu, they discussed a law that compensates kids featured in online content. That law took effect in 2024, Illinois the first state to pass such a law. They spoke with Sasha Ann Simons. Carolyn Isom and Shreya Nelamultu discussing a state law that compensates kids who are featured in online content. And they spoke with Sasha Ann Simons. We'll be back with more of Statewide right after this. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Roller derby is resilient, just like the skaters who keep the sport alive. Roller derby was arguably at the peak in its public popularity decades ago, but a revival in the early 2000s has brought a new generation of skaters into the sport. That includes the women and men of the Prairieland Punishers, a team that includes Bloomington Normal skaters. And as Vashti Reed reports, the Punishers are emerging from the pandemic with another way to evolve the sport.
Normally, the only sounds you hear at Maroa City Hall are city council meetings or people stopping by to get a building permit. But tonight, a large hall on the backside of City Hall is home to a Prairieland Punishers roller derby team practice. They're practicing for their next bout, a doubleheader Saturday, September 6th, at the Interstate Center. And it's not just any bout. The 7 o'clock showdown is the first ever bout open to both women and men that's sanctioned by the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, also known as WFDA. Punisher skater Sierra Henry from Bloomington says that the open division bout is a big deal.
Hopefully there's going to be more opportunities for roller derby in Central Illinois and beyond. I know that there were a lot of leagues that folded during COVID, and so being able to bring everyone together through this bout is really incredible.
The Prairieland Punishers formed in Decatur about 14 years ago. It's since grown into a regional team with skaters from Bloomington, Peoria, Champaign, Springfield, and Decatur. The Punishers invited WGLT to a recent practice in Maroa, about 30 miles south of Bloomington. The first thing we wanted to know was, how do you win a roller derby bout? It starts with the two types of skaters, jammers and blockers. We'll let a skater known as Goldie Rocks from Pekin explain the rest.
Well, you win by getting the most points, and you get points because by the jammer passing blockers. So every blocker that a jammer passes, they get a point for. I'm a blocker, and the jammer wears a star. This is why my shirt says blockers aim for the stars, because I'm going for that jammer, that star, trying to prevent that person from passing me.
If it sounds a little bit chaotic, that's because it is. Melissa Sylvester, aka Smash Tag, one of the team captains, says roller derby is unique.
It's the only sport that I know of that you play offense and defense at the same time.
What makes a good skater? Practice helps, but it's also an attitude, a skill set, and a will to win.
What makes a great skater is the wanting to be a great skater, putting in the effort, putting in the time on skates. That's what makes somebody a great skater.
The Punishers like winning, but it's clear it's about more than winning. On this close-knit team, friendships form fast. Being part of a team like this also opens some skaters' eyes to new experiences, new surroundings, and new people.
I think it's the people, it's the camaraderie, the friendships. I met my best friend through roller derby, so I met my husband through roller derby.
Here's Punisher skater David France, who goes by the derby name Havoc. He'll be one of the men skating in the open gender division.
For me, I do derby for the practices. That's where you come, you see your friends, you spend time with friends, you work together to do certain things, to accomplish things. You're trying to make them better, they're trying to make you better. And it ends up being like, ends up a relationship where you start supporting each other on the track, and then you have a family that you has your back and supports you off the track also.
Relationships are not all roller derby offers to these skaters. They also get some bruises and sometimes full-blown injuries.
My first year, in my very first game, I broke my ankle and tore all the ligaments on the right side of my foot. I've had a couple of concussions And I have had a broken nose and broken orbital socket, which is why I wear a visor now.
And given their high impact, high injury hobby, most of the skaters we interviewed have relatively normal day jobs.
I am the senior media relations specialist with Illinois Farm Bureau.
I'm an IT manager for automotive manufacturer.
I am what you would call a product analyst.
I work for the Postal Service.
You can catch the Prairieland Punishers in action during Saturday's doubleheader. They'll start at 5 with a bout against Demolition City Roller Derby from Evansville, Indiana. Then at 7, it's the sanctioned open gender bout with the Peoria Prowlers. Fans are welcomed at both. And if you catch the roller derby bug and want to try it yourself, the Punishers are hosting an open gendered boot camp on September 19th. All skate levels are welcomed and no prior experience is needed. Here's some closing advice from Havoc.
Show up. One moment can change your life. You can have friends for the rest of your life, but if you don't show up and make yourself present, nothing will ever happen.
I'm Vashti Reed.
The president of a union representing university employees in Illinois says they will be pushing state lawmakers next year to improve funding for the institutions. Rich Egger reports they're promoting a plan to generate more revenue through a tax on the wealthy.
Next year is an election year for statewide offices and many state lawmakers, so they might be disinclined to take on any potentially controversial issues. But John Miller says elections should not be an excuse to pass on an issue that's been lingering for too long.
I like to tell folks to think about how much money you made in 2002 and imagine living on that today. And that's what the state has done for public higher education, with the exception of one university, and that's Urbana-Champaign.
He's quick to add that he's glad the state's flagship university is well-funded, but he says the state's other public universities and their students deserve a similar investment. Miller is president of the University Professionals of Illinois, Local 4100. The union represents workers at many of the state's regional universities.
Regional institutions reach out to new generation students, first generation of students, and moves this state forward in ways that only a regional university is able to do, and that's what attracts businesses.
Miller says part of the issue is the state's revenue system. He says a change is needed. He supports a funding equity bill that would generate revenue through a new tax on those making at least $1 million a year. He says Illinois voters have twice supported advisory referenda for such a tax, and he cites Massachusetts as an example of how that would work. Massachusetts voters approved the Fair Share Amendment in 2022. It imposes a 4% surtax on annual taxable income exceeding $1 million.
We brought that to Illinois. It would produce $4 billion for the state of Illinois. That would start to fund higher education, K through 12. It would also be able to help with some of the cuts that occurred in Medicaid and SNAP.
He says the additional funding for K through 12 and community colleges would result in lower property taxes. The Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center says the amendment is generating billions of dollars for public education and transportation in that state. Miller says other steps are also possible for Illinois.
There have been tax code changes on the federal level that gave big corporations, millionaires, billionaires, significant amount of money, and yet the state still has tax breaks for Google, Apple, Amazon, and so forth. Like, why are we giving these companies this money when we need this money for our education, for our own students?
Miller does not believe the wealthy and businesses will leave the state if a tax is imposed on millionaires. He says more people have moved into Massachusetts since its Fair Share Amendment was approved. He believes that's due in part to the resulting investment in education and transportation.
It's what businesses and people want.
Miller is also part of the new leadership team for the Illinois Federation of Teachers. He's their membership secretary. Miller feels his roles with UPI and IFT overlap. He says both are about improving education in Illinois and funding it adequately. Rich Egger reporting.
Research shows education in prison works to rehabilitate incarcerated people, give them opportunities after prison, and decrease the chance they'll end up back behind bars. But quality education programs don't exist at every prison in Illinois. Those that do are often interrupted by lockdowns, where the incarcerated are confined to their cells all day. And as part of our prison education series, Emily Hayes has more on the rash of lockdowns in the state's prisons and the possible solutions.
Calvin Mayfield wants to be in class all day. He's incarcerated at Pinckneyville Correctional Center in Southern Illinois and has been taking a culinary arts course.
Everything's kind of new, and learning about how restaurants, you know, kind of behind the scenes are run is, it's interesting. I kind of didn't know it was that involved.
His classes start at 8:30 a.m. and run until 4 p.m. with a lunch break. But oftentimes he learns just 1 hour before that his classes are canceled for the day.
Culinary arts is 4 days a week, but there'll be weeks where we'll only go over there one or maybe two times because when we're on lockdown, they cancel school.
Since COVID-19, prisons across the United States have increasingly turned to lockdowns to handle staffing shortages. And in Illinois, the number of lockdowns has been rising. State prisons are now in lockdown almost twice as many days per year as they were during the pandemic.
During lockdowns, prisoners are in their cell just about 24 hours a day. They don't even get recreation.
Dr. Terry A. Coopers is a psychiatrist who studies the effects of prison conditions. He says he considers lockdowns a form of solitary confinement.
It's been determined by the United Nations that more than 15 days in solitary confinement constitutes a human rights abuse and torture.
Coopers has toured prisons across the country and performed psychiatric examinations of those in solitary. He says it's very common to see high rates of anxiety, panic disorder, sleeping problems, and hopelessness. And it affects their ability to learn.
I asked prisoners in solitary, if I was in solitary, I would read everything I can get a hold of. Why don't you read more? And they say, I can't remember what I read the page before. That's a very widespread concentration problem, and we have brain studies that show why that happens.
Most lockdowns in Illinois last year were related to staffing or administrative decisions, not incidents of self-harm or violence among the incarcerated.
I understand the staff shortages, but staff shortage is not an excuse for abusing prisoners.
The Illinois Department of Corrections says it acknowledges there's been an increase in total lockdowns and is taking steps to address the issue. A spokesperson for the department says those efforts include boosting recruitment, setting up more training academies, and new wellness initiatives like staff decompression rooms in every facility. Some prisons have a solution to keep classes going even during lockdowns. Jason Baer is the staff member in charge of peer education programs at Danville Correctional Center. He says these group mentoring classes led by those in prison at Danville help alleviate the stresses of lockdowns.
I'm out, I'm talking to somebody, it's a release of energy. I'm not sitting, I'm not mad. I've walked wings on lockdowns lots of times, and you feel when are we done? I mean, just as simple as 30 or 45 minutes, that's gonna slow that down a little bit.
Susan Dewey is a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Alabama. She thinks peer mentoring can be an antidote to the staff shortages that have long existed in prisons.
What can we do with the resources that we have? And peer mentoring is a big answer to that and has been for a very long time.
Peer mentoring doesn't have the same track record as university classes, which help those in prison turn their lives around more than other forms of education. But Dewey says higher ed courses have a limited reach.
It's a teeny tiny minority of people in prison who have access to those, honestly, too, and who want to participate, right, for a whole lot of reasons. So peer mentoring is something everyone can do.
But Calvin Mayfield would really like to take a university course. There just aren't any available at Pinckneyville. That's why he's trying to transfer to another prison that does have access. Mayfield's sentence lasts until 2036 for sexual assault and other charges.
When I get out, I'm going to be 60, and I'm going to have to work, you know, for the rest of my life, you know, to support myself. So I think an education would really help me open more doors for me when I get out, you know. Maybe people would see that I was really trying to better myself in prison.
While waiting for his transfer, he would like to take the class he has access to instead of facing lockdowns from staff shortages.
They've been saying that for so many years that you would think after so long they would, you know, change the way they do things if they can't hire enough people if nobody wants to work here. Seems like they would have to change the way they operate, you know. It's not fair to just to say, oh, well, nobody came to work today, so we're just not going to let you out.
The Illinois Department of Corrections says one obstacle to continuing peer education during lockdowns is that peer-led programs usually need a large gathering space outside of housing units. But the department is encouraging each prison to adjust its lockdown procedures to keep as many daily activities going as possible. I'm Emily Hayes.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.